All rise. Oyez. United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. Honorable Alan G. Lance presiding. All about business before this court draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. My name is Judge Lance. To my right is Judge Schoen. To my left is Judge Bartley. We're here at the appointed time, date, and location for the hearing in the matter of Eric Cantrell versus David Shulkin, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, docket number 15-3439. Counsel, would you please each identify yourself for the record?
Barbara Cook of the law firm Chisholm & Kilpatrick on behalf of the appellant. With me at counsel table is Christian McCarrigan, also of the law firm.
Welcome.
Omar Youssef on behalf of the Secretary, and with me is Kenneth Walsh.
Welcome. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
You care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I would like to reserve.
You have the burden of proof?
I would like to reserve 10 minutes, if I may, Your Honor.
10 minutes. Please make it so. Proceed.
Thank you, and may it please the Court. The Secretary has, in his own words, purposely chosen not to define the term employment in protected work environment. That's from page 12 of his supplemental pleading. But both parties and this court need a clear definition of the terms used for adjudicating cases, because otherwise the adjudication is arbitrary. The appellant today is therefore asking that this court define the term protected work environment for the VA and for the appellants, either by adopting the definition as first suggested by the Secretary at page 3 of his supplemental pleading, that marginal work, and hence protected work, which is a subpart of marginal, means barely exceeding the minimum requirements of work, or by adopting the definition suggested by appellant, that protected work exists where the employer provides accommodations that allow the veteran to remain employed even though he is not meeting the normal, i.e. essential functions, all the essential functions of the job.
Well, getting to your point, which is you'd like the court to write the regulations for the Secretary?
I didn't mean to interrupt you, Judge, if you wanted to.
Well, I just.
I'm not asking.
I point out that we expect the Secretary to write the regulations, and we will interpret them. How's that?
I agree, and that's what I'm asking the court to do, is to interpret the regulation. The term in the regulation is protected environment, work in a protected environment. And it does not have a definition, and the Secretary has acknowledged it doesn't have a definition, and the Secretary has said he's not going to provide a definition. What it has is examples. And this court, the Secretary has been encouraged since 1987 to have a definition. The GAO encouraged the Secretary to do so in 1987. This court has encouraged the Secretary to define the terms in that regulation since 1990, I believe. Again, as recently as last year in Ortiz-Valles. But the Secretary has not defined the term. So it's not a matter of writing the regulation. The regulation is fine as it stands. It's a matter of defining the terms, just as the court did in Faust. It defined the term substantial gainful employment in terms of the monetary test used for determining whether something is or is not substantial employment.
And, you know, in Faust, I believe the court found that because the veteran made over the poverty threshold, his employment was not marginal, but was indeed substantially gainful. So given that you just said that a protected environment is a kind of a subcategory of marginal employment, would the veteran's income here play a part in this whole determination?
No, I don't think it does, Judge, because the income is a separate test. The income is if your income is below the poverty level, then by that definition, you can meet the test of substantially of not being involved in substantially gainful occupation, if the reason for that is your service-connected disability. But this is an alternative method. A protected work environment is an alternative method to find that the person is entitled to a 100% rating under TDIU. And what it looks at is the circumstances in which an individual is earning more than the poverty level.
Well, and how much was the veteran making, let's say, during the years? He just retired, right, in February?
Yes, he did retire, correct.
And so we're talking about from the years 2006?
Yes, from 2000. Okay. He filed his claim in 2006.
So what was his range of income?
Judge Bartley, I believe I have the answer, and it was $32,950 a year.
Okay. Thank you, Judge Lance. I was estimating around 30, but yes. So, but the reason he was able to bring that income in is because of the very significant accommodations that the employer was making. He was excused from performing the essential functions of his job. He was permitted to leave the scenes of emergency work. He was permitted to leave unexpectedly during the day. He was permitted to take excessive breaks, take naps at will.
So you're arguing that accommodations alone, the Secretary hasn't, at least in your view, provided any kind of guidance as to what a protected environment would be, but is your argument that accommodations alone, regardless of income, could meet the protected environment and thus the marginal employment requirement?
If the accommodations are significant, if the accommodations are unreasonable, to contrast it with the reasonable accommodations required under the Americans with Disability Act, then yes.
So I'm just, this gives me pause, quite a bit of pause really, this kind of open, very open suggested definition. What if, like, okay, family business is one of the types of protected environments that's listed. What if Mark Zuckerberg pays his brother, who's a veteran, who's disabled, $100,000 a year to do something in the family business? he's making $100,000, but he is disabled and perhaps could not work because of a service-connected disability. Should he, just because of the accommodations allowed him by the employer, i.e. family, would he, without consideration of income, be eligible under this provision?
Yes, because what it says is essentially that in the circumstance you're talking about, the $100,000 is essentially a gift. That if he's not performing the essential functions of the job that he's hired for, then he's not, and the reason he cannot perform those essential functions is because of his service-connected disability, then he otherwise would not be able to work. And I can appreciate the concern. I don't think it's going to happen very often that someone's making $100,000.
Or even 50. People who get TDIU are going to get, is it around $30,000,
$35,000
a year now?
That's correct.
You're asking us to allow Mr. Cantrell to receive for these years from 2006 to current time, $35,000 or, you know, whatever it was in 2006.
If I can interject, is it really $35,000 or is it the differential between what his service-connected disability entitled him to and the 100% rating for TDIU?
Yeah, well,
I don't know what that is, but.
I believe that's a question for you.
Thank you, Judge. Within the compensation provisions, my understanding is that income is not balanced against it. But what the question, underlying question, I think, attacks the regulation itself. And the regulation is a good regulation. The Secretary should be proud of this regulation, because what it does is that it allows veterans who otherwise could not work, it allows them to actually work, to have the dignity of work. It rewards them for that. It turns them into tax-paying citizens. It allows employers to hire veterans, as this employer did, even though the employer had to make significant, huge accommodations to the veteran. And so that's a good thing. And that is what the regulation says. It provides for that situation. And the two examples in the regulation, sheltered work and family work, share the criteria they share in terms of what makes them examples of protected work are that in those situations, the person's deficiencies in terms of reliability and productivity are forgiven. And as I say, that is something that the VA should, we should be applauding the VA for taking that step. And that is a longstanding rule that they have had, and it makes sense to allow for that.
So your argument is accommodations alone, the extent of the accommodations.
Significant accommodations, which I think are not, I don't imagine that they're that common. We don't know. They certainly existed in this case.
Counselor, your client was making $32,950 a year.
Correct.
Full-time employment, receiving the same compensation, I assume, than his fellow workers were. Right. Also receiving between 60% and 80% disability rating, right?
Correct.
All right. So at what point do we cross the Rubicon of unjust enrichment? When does this kick in?
Well, I think that would be up to the Secretary to define in a regulation. But under the current regulation, it does not, because the definition of protected work, a proper definition of protected work environment, acknowledges that this person would not be doing this other than these significant accommodations. And I would just point out that in terms of him working full time, his work was being forgiven. He was not attending meetings. He was not on task.
I'm familiar with the record.
For more than an hour a day. So it is what is envisioned by the regulation.
If we were to accept your assessment of how protected work environment should be defined, that a significant accommodation would be necessary, would an expert opinion be necessary for VA to determine what is a significant accommodation versus a not so significant accommodation?
I don't think necessarily it would be. There was one in this case, but I think that had the board had the proper definition here, it could have recognized, even without the expert, that this was a significant accommodation based on the evidence from the supervisor, who said if I didn't provide these accommodations, I would have fired him. And if I can make one more comment about in terms of the meaning of the regulation, one of the things that the regulation does is to recognize that the vocational impact from certainly from a combination of disabilities is not always going to be reflected in the actual rating because of the way VA does their ratings. VA doesn't add the percentages together. As we know, it combines them. And so in Mr. Cantrell's case, if you add his disabilities together, he's at 140%. But he doesn't get 140%, he gets 90% because of this combined effect where the VA says, well, once you get a 50%, then the subsequent disabilities have, in VA belief, have no impact on the rest of your life. But in fact, there is a collective impact, and that's what 416 helps counter.
Well, isn't a disability rating predicated upon loss of an incapacity?
It is,
okay,
but...
So we've got your client making a full-time wage and a full-time job, plus he's been previously adjudicated between 60 and 80%, right? Loss of earning capacity, correct? All right. And now through the TDIU mechanism, we're talking about kicking that up to 100%, right?
Yes, because that is what the rule says.
Plus his wages, which are a full-time wage.
Yes, but that is what the rule requires. You expressed concern.
Well, that's your interpretation, right?
Well, it's not. It's also this court's interpretation. In Ortiz-Valles, the court said that the fact that a person is working does not preclude him from getting TDIU under a protected work environment. And what do those phrases mean? What does facts found such as family and sheltered mean, other than the fact that there is some way of providing that an individual who's working, even full-time, is nonetheless possibly eligible for receiving a full 100% disability rating. Imagine...
Do we need to reach a definition of marginal employment to decide this case? And I know that you, I forget who suggested it first, but perhaps it was the Secretary, but in your reply, or in your response to our order, you quoted a definition that I believe was provided by the Secretary. Marginal employment defined as close to the lower limit of qualification, acceptability, or function, and barely exceeding the minimum requirements. Can you explain what that means? Like, when I read that close to the lower limit of qualification, acceptability, or function, I'm confused as to whether it's the job itself is marginal or the type of work required is marginal, or the veteran's ability to perform the work is marginal, or the pay is marginal. I mean, what are you going with here?
Well, I saw that the Secretary's definition as a point on a spectrum, that we had suggested a definition of someone who's working only because they are getting unreasonable, excessive accommodations, you know, those that are not required by law, at one end of the spectrum. In the middle would be Social Security's view, which is that even a person who is getting reasonable accommodations can work and still collect Social Security disability benefits. And then at the other end is the Secretary's definition of marginal, which doesn't take accommodations into account at all. It just says that I saw it as the person is performing the job, but barely. And so under any of these definitions, the veteran, Mr. Cantrell, qualifies. I think there can be no question but that if his brother had hired him and provided these accommodations, the board probably would have said, right, it's a family situation, you're in a protected work environment. But because he wasn't hired by his brother, he was hired by the state of Tennessee or the county, then somehow it was different. But it's not. The criteria are the same. And what ultimately needs to happen is for there to be a definition. This entire discussion depends on what the proper definition is. Because if the definition requires income or doesn't require income, that's part of the definition. But the board didn't have a definition.
Why do you accept the proposition that the accommodation has to be unreasonable? Like, why does the ADA play a role in the TDIU determination, in your view?
Because I think that the ADA says that the, anticipates rather, that the accommodations that are provided are very minor. They do not, by definition, affect the essential functions of the job. They tend to be things like, you know, if the job requires that, typically requires that the person stand, but it could be done by sitting, then the employer has to provide a chair and allow the individual to sit while they're doing the job. But it doesn't, and so I
because you think the accommodations that are reasonable are minor, that's your...
Yes, yes.
I believe you stated earlier that Social Security does not consider whether accommodations are made. It's whether the person can do the job or not do the job.
That's my understanding.
So that would be a more liberal standard than what you are proposing.
Correct.
And, okay.
And I would say that it was just, it, I mean, our definition is that at a minimum it requires that, but that's the reason, is that it just seemed like I say, at a minimum it should be that. But the Secretary has proposed that marginal be broader than that, and we are certainly content to have a very broad definition as well.
And in terms of this case, your client applied for Social Security disability in 2006, did he not?
I believe that's correct, Judge.
And he was denied that by the Social Security Administration?
He was denied then.
Okay, just for purposes of clarification. Judge Bartley.
Earlier I had asked, do we need to reach a definition of marginal to decide this case, or do we just need to focus on what is protected employment?
I think you simply have to decide that the basics is that you would have to decide, or we're asking that you decide, a definition of protected work environment, and not necessarily define marginal.
Okay, Counselor, you have 30 minutes to think about that a little bit. Counsel for the Secretary, please.
Morning. May it please the Court. The Secretary respectfully submits that the Court should affirm the Board's determination that appellant is not entitled to TDIU for two reasons. First, the Board denied TDIU in a manner consistent with the plain meaning of 4.16. And second, the specific facts of appellant's case show that the nature of his job as a park ranger does not qualify as marginal or protected. As to the first point, the Board's decision is consistent with the plain meaning of the regulation, and that should control here. While the regulation provides that marginal employment generally exists when a veteran's annual income does not exceed the established poverty level, it also allows for the possibility that it may exist in exceptional situations when a veteran's annual income does exceed that level. Despite appellant's arguments to the contrary, the Secretary has chosen a subjective standard that is ascertainable and flexible so as to sufficiently account for the specific facts of such extraordinary cases. As reflected in the regulatory history, as provided in the pleadings, and the plain language of the regulation, the Secretary has chosen to empower its adjudicators to make the factual determination in these exceptional cases. That language must control.
I actually don't necessarily see that in the regulatory history. When I look at the promulgation and the final rule, they talk about, oh, it was unclear what was meant by marginal employment in situations that exceed the earning the poverty threshold. So VA said, yeah, we agree, so we're going to give examples. To me, that's VA's intent to provide something more specific, not to just say, you'll know it when you see it, which is what the problem was highlighted in the GAO report and the inequality or different standards that were applied prior to the change in the regulation. So did VA really mean to give total subjectivity to its adjudicators?
Your Honor, the Secretary, when it revised the regulation, it did intend to apply that subjective standard. the intent was done to propose a common definition of marginal employment, and the examples provide a framework that the adjudicators can look to.
Can you point to me somewhere where it says we intended to give flexibility and subjectivity to the adjudicators in the regulatory history, specifically?
Just a second.
Yes.
Your Honor, we would note three specific examples that would go to that point. The authority is not unfettered, but we think that we would submit that the examples provide the standard that they should look to. In the first instance, the examples that are provided, again, those provide a framework, and those are the extent that of the authority that the agency has. It cannot exceed that authority.
Although it says such as.
Correct. So the list is non-exhaustive. So
they can't exceed those two things.
Well, there's a common thread that exists between these examples. Essentially, somebody is employing a person who may have a disability, and they are allowing them to work in that environment while the employer is incurring some type of loss, whether it is a family business where the person may not be employable but for working for family, or whether it's a sheltered workshop in a charitable organization of some type. And the marginal employment is, the term is essentially an umbrella term under which protected environment is but one example. There are other potential examples, but those are to be determined by the adjudicators individually on, you know, in a case. The examples of a family business or a sheltered workshop are then attached to the definition of, or the example of, a protected work environment. So there are three different tiers here that the agency has elaborated or indicated in the regulatory history. The agency has also noted in the Federal Register that when they were amending the reg, one of the commentators suggested that we adopt the definition that was proposed in 4.17, but the agency disagreed that the proposed rule would require veterans to seek employment near the poverty level. And the exceptional situation that I noted, when the veteran's income exceeds the poverty level, supports that, because it allows for veterans to seek employment that is not limited to just the poverty level. So the Federal Register, we believe, is representative of the agency's position that marginal employment is to be determined on a fact-found basis individually by the adjudicators, and the examples provide the framework for them to look to.
Counselor, following on to Judge Sullivan's question, how is this court supposed to review this? We'll know it when we see it, and we'll let you know, standard that you indicate that the Secretary has adopted.
Your Honor, the court, this is similar to other factual findings that the agency is empowered to make, such as weighing the evidence or assessing the credibility of lay evidence. The agency's adjudicators make those findings, and then those findings are subject to judicial review under the clearly erroneous standard.
And that gets us into the facts of the case versus the law of the case, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And so at that point in time, we're just kind of out there freelancing, so to speak, and applying what we think are the best practices and the best approach to that particular case in an equitable manner. Is that it?
Your Honor, the agency would, the adjudicators would consider the facts of the case in total. I know my colleague had suggested that the regulation does not consider accommodations, but this is untrue. The Secretary submits that the regulation states that consideration should be given in all claims to the nature of the employment, and the nature of the employment includes the accommodations that the veteran may receive at his or her job. So the standard is very flexible, and it is subjective. That is then subject to review on appeal.
And again, following on to Judge Sholin's question, the GAO, I believe it was in 86, suggested that the Secretary take a look at putting this into some sort of a standard that could be evaluated and reviewed?
Yes, Your Honor.
And would you agree that no action was taken after that recommendation?
Respectfully, Your Honor, we would disagree. We think that the agency did take action, and the extent of the action is reflected in the examples that were listed. The Secretary intended for those examples to, basically that was the Secretary's response to the GAO report.
Well, should the Secretary have occasion to revisit that, you know, you might consider using numbers, dollars and cents versus abstract terms, which are more difficult for the court to be able to review in a meaningful manner.
The board found that his employment wasn't protected in part because the accommodations he received allowed him to perform his job successfully. Isn't the point of working in a protected environment to allow the person to perform duties?
Yes, Your Honor, but the protected work environment contemplates a situation where the veteran would not be able to work in a competitive field like he's working here. He is employed by the state park in the county where he lives, and as the board noted, he has extensive job responsibilities, which include patrolling the park, looking for rule violators, and Appellant's counsel suggested that he is unable to perform the essential duties of his job, but his employer actually noted that he has essentially the same duties, but for registering campers that he had in.
And he can't do emergency scene matters.
Correct.
And he has to leave frequently, so other people have to do his duties.
Correct, Your Honor, but we do not believe that that would take him into the realm of a protected environment.
So you're saying somebody who has a decent job with any level of responsibility is ineligible for TDIU from VA?
No,
Your Honor. So a lawyer, for example, who worked one day a week and had other lawyers backing them up, clearly making more than the poverty threshold, would be ineligible for TDIU because that's a competitive job.
No, Your Honor, that would depend on the facts of that specific case.
I don't understand how a competitive work environment makes a difference if the level of accommodations that that particular employer is willing to take are so significant that the person could not do the job without those kinds of accommodations.
Your Honor, it may not necessarily be different from a protected environment where somebody is working in a family business, but that is specific to that specific instance. It does not translate out into a general setting because the agency has determined that determination in these exceptional situations cannot be construed in a more objective fashion.
We'll continue. I'd like to ask some questions about the board's invocation of the ADA and reasonable accommodations. What is the board's authority for looking at the ADA?
Your Honor, the ADA is not binding here, but the board can, the agency has empowered its adjudicators to consider what other agencies have found, and they weigh that. They consider it and see if it's applicable to their specific case.
Didn't this court in Beatty say that the VA couldn't look at Social Security determinations to deny a veteran benefits because it was sort of selectively using them? It hadn't employed Social Security to be helpful for veterans, so it couldn't employ Social Security to be hurtful to veterans. I can give you the citation. It is 6 Vet App 532. It's a 1994 case. The court found no statutory or regulatory authority for the determinative application of SSA regulations to the adjudication of VA claims and stated that the board may not in certain cases choose to apply SSA regulations that were never been adopted by the Secretary as applicable to VA adjudication. So I'm unclear how the board can look to outside, be it Department of Labor, as Social Security, Americans with Disability Act authority to guide its determinations.
Your Honor, our position is that the board cannot look only to what other agencies have determined, because the board cannot per se deny a veteran's claim. As in contrast to the Social Security framework, VA is not an all or nothing system. VA allows for incremental disabilities, whereas in Social Security, a person
well,
is not.
In Beatty, VA was citing Social Security to deny a veteran as opposed to, you know, but anyway, I appreciate what you're saying. But I think the basis of that and also the Supreme Court case Cleveland talking about how Social Security and ADA interact, part of that was that the Social Security administrative law judges don't have expertise in determining what is a reasonable accommodation. How does the Board of Veterans Appeals or a regional office employee have authority to determine what's a reasonable accommodation?
Your Honor, they would consider it as a part of the case, as a factual inquiry to make.
So could a veteran then challenge that, no, the accommodation is unreasonable, and that that somehow makes a difference?
Your Honor, it could conceivably make a difference to the nature of the employment. So the accommodation can render the employment, it may render the employment protected or not based on the overall picture that, or based on the overall disability picture that the veteran experiences based on his employment. But in and of itself, the Secretary submits that the accommodations are not dispositive. The Appellant's counsel has suggested or pointed out that the Secretary noted certain definitions in his supplemental pleadings and asked the court to adopt those definitions, but the Secretary submits that he has not actually done so. Those were examples that the Secretary was providing the court to show that these examples and the definitions that the Appellant's counsel submits are not necessarily more workable than what is already provided. He has essentially created an abstract point in a continuum and basically disagrees with the current standard that's espoused in the regulation.
I just wanted to point out or get your thoughts on one of your manual provisions in Part 4, Subpart 2, Chapter 2, Section F. There's a discussion about TDIU and determining it in a tightly held corporation or a closely held corporation or i.e. family business. And this provision says the following. Do not make a finding of marginal employment solely on the basis of low wages. To me, that means that wages are a factor in the marginal employment context. It also says, keep in mind that the issue for consideration is whether the frequency and type of service performed by the veteran would equate to substantially gainful employment. So that seems to bring in two other factors, frequency of service performed and type of service performed. And so I was confused in reading your materials about why. I understand that the reg itself doesn't, it has examples, but it doesn't have a lot of guidance about what you were calling before common threads in the examples. I was left to kind of guess, what are the common threads between a sheltered workshop and a family business? But reading this manual provision, it seems like these are the factors that the manual recommends be reviewed. So do you think that this is not important? Why didn't you use this? Or what's the relevance of this provision in this discussion?
Your Honor, may I have leave to? Your Honor, the M21 is essentially those provisions are to make sure that the first line raters who look at a case do not discard the claim solely based on income. The income, the Secretary submits, is relevant to a determination. In the first instance, when it does not exceed the poverty level, it and the veteran is considered to be unemployable, he's determined to be unemployable, it is dispositive in that case. In the second exceptional situation, as we have here, VA considered that the income may be relevant. It becomes essentially another factor. And that provision in the regulation allows for veterans to earn unemployment benefits even if their income exceeds the poverty level. So the factors that you would...
Right, I get, but just because you can get TDIU if your income exceeds the poverty threshold, it doesn't mean that it's not a factor. You already just said it can be a factor.
Yes, sir.
This is what you're saying.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you're being really, it's very amorphous. And it was kind of surprising in your pleadings. It was kind of like you seemed proud that it was amorphous. And understand that makes it very difficult for us whenever we're trying to decide, like, was this the right decision as to Mr. Cantrell or the wrong decision? It's like, I don't know, how do you hold on to anything? It's like trying to hold on to air.
Yes, Your Honor, I understand. But we would submit that the examples are, again, they reflect that common thread. And they reflect that, there has to be some, there has to be this common thread that runs through these cases, and the examples are emblematic of that.
And the common thread, you said earlier, is that the employer is incurring some kind of loss?
It is suggestive of that, yes, Your Honor.
So what kind of loss would be an example that would be a winning kind of loss for the veteran?
Well, Your Honor, if somebody employs a member of their family who would not otherwise be able to work in a different setting, in, for example, as a park ranger, that person may or may not be able to perform the duties that another person would in that specific job, but his family member is allowing him to work. And that person is incurring a loss because he may not be experiencing or gaining as much profit as somebody else would by allowing somebody else to live there.
So applying that logic to Mr. Cantrell's case, his boss talked about that he had to pay overtime for people to cover him, and that Mr. Cantrell used a lot of leave because of his illness, and there are duties that he couldn't fulfill because types of work that he couldn't do, and only types of assignments that he would drive around in a truck, he would be in areas where there were bathrooms. So why is that not the same as I hired my cousin who can't do everything and I'm having to incur an economic loss in addition to a productivity loss because I have to pay this guy overtime to cover for my cousin who can't be there all the time?
Your Honor, because the record does not reflect that his employment is sheltered or family in any way, and he is able to work, and he is compensated for his current level of impairment.
Right, but what if I paid my cousin the same amount that I pay Mr. Lance, who also works for me but works full time?
Right, but Your Honor, the question then becomes whether that specific person, in this example, your cousin, would be able to engage in employment, what their capacity level is.
Doesn't Mr. Cantrell's supervisor say that but for these accommodations, I would not be able to keep him on?
Your Honor, he did state that, but that does not mean that he would not be able to find other employment. His applications for TDIU,
Did the board make that determination, or did they just make the determination that this job was not protected?
Your Honor, all TDIU applications are concerned with the capacity to earn,
right,
not necessarily this specific job.
But, well, anyway, I'll check myself. But go ahead, Judge Bartley, please.
Well, yeah, I'm a little confused about the several mentions here by some of my fellow judges and by counsel about the number of hours worked. Because in Faust, we held that a substantially gainful occupation is one that provides annual income that exceeds the poverty threshold for one person, irrespective of the number of hours or days that the veteran actually works and without regard to his prior income prior to having been awarded TDIU. So, I mean, are hours worked and missing work? What's the, I mean, what, is that a factor to be considered in this assessment?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. We think that he has demonstrated, in fact, he has indicated himself that he's able to work 40 hours a week. His application stated that he only missed 2 to 3 days a month.
So it's a factor, and it was considered in
the story. Yes, Your Honor, that was a factor that was considered here. Your Honor, if I may, just very briefly as to the extra scheduler argument, just state that the only relationship that the record shows that exists between the disabilities is etiological, and that would be wholly irrelevant to a question or a determination of extra scheduler because it does not show anything exceptional or unusual. And if there are no further questions, the Secretary respectfully asks the Court to affirm the Board's decision.
Well, salary and actual monetary compensation would be a fairly easy measurement, would it not?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it could be verified with tax returns?
Yes, Your Honor.
And we wouldn't have to dig into the familial relationship of the employer or the employee and whether or not it was a reasonable accommodation or not a reasonable accommodation. It's just a dollar and cent application, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Has the Secretary ever considered that?
Your Honor, the Secretary is continuously revising the regulation as he determines best.
He's never called you and asked you that question?
No, Your Honor, he has not.
What would your answer be if he had not?
Well, I just find it kind of in never-never land when we say we're doing this on a facts-found basis and we think that the facts support this, but we don't have anything to anchor it to in terms of firm, hard regulations or empirical data or evidence. So I just pass that observation on.
Yes, Your Honor.
Judge, thank you very much. Counselor, you have 10 whole minutes.
Thank you. The Secretary has today proposed a new definition, one that was not in his pleadings, that the regulation means, that protected work environment means that one is incurring a loss, the employer is incurring a loss. That's not the definition the board used. So at the very least, it means this case should go back under that definition. I'm not sure that sheltered employment fits that definition. I'm not sure that sheltered workshop employers suffer a loss simply because they're nonprofit. But the facts here show that the employer was incurring a loss. As you pointed out, Judge Scholin, he was paying people overtime that he wouldn't have otherwise had to pay. And he was paying Mr. Cantrell a full-time salary for what was essentially part-time work. He was not working 40 hours a week. He was taking significant bathroom breaks. He was not available the entire time. He was off task for a significant part of the time. And when you asked him about that, Judge Scholin, the Secretary said, well, but that doesn't, that's not the same thing as incurring a loss because he's not in a protected work environment. In other words, it's circular. I understand and certainly agree that adjudicators should decide cases based on the facts, but without a standard, then any adjudicator can grant any claim. A rogue adjudicator can grant TDIU benefits under protected work environment to every one of his friends. He can just teach them how to submit affidavits and grant them based on facts found. But facts found is simply not a standard. And the issue isn't whether the veteran can work. The issue is whether, and it's not whether he can work successfully or work full time. The issue is whether he does that because he's in a protected work environment, because there are significant accommodations. And we cannot decide that. This court cannot decide it. The adjudicators cannot decide it unless there is a definition. And so for that reason, we ask that the court set aside the board decision and either define the term under one of the definitions proposed or remand for adjudication under a clear definition of the term protected work environment.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think, as the parties are aware, there was a late filing requesting that we consider a couple of cases. That motion is pending, and we will deal with it as part of this decision. The matter is now under advisement, and we'll greet counsel at this time. Thank you.
All right.
Court is in recess.
Thank you.
Thank you.